Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. Thank you for tuning into the podcast. We very much appreciate your time. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider a tax-deductible donation to help support the series. Pardes is a small institution, so your donation of any amount makes a real difference for us. You can donate anytime online via www.donate.pardesusa.org. Thank you for considering a donation to Pardes. A short announcement for our New York listeners is that Rabbi Daniel Landis, the director and Rosh HaYeshiva of Pardes, will be speaking this Friday, November 30th, in Manhattan. His shiur is entitled The Zohar on Joseph's Dreams. Rabbi Landis will be speaking immediately after Friday evening services at the Jewish Center, 131 West 86th Street. Services start with Mincha at 4:15 p.m. All are welcome. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Parshat Vayishev. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as the Pardes Mashiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parshat Vayeshev. We will be examining the personalities of Shimon and Levi. Let us begin by looking at last week's parsha. Chapter 34. The story of the rape of Dinah. After Dinah is raped by Shechem, the son of Hamor, she is kept hostage. Shechem seeks to marry her and enters into negotiations with her family. What is the response of Yaakov when he hears of the rape? He is silent. He waits for his sons to come home. When the sons come home, they're appalled. They're saddened. They are angry. Chapter 34, verse 7. An abomination has been done in Israel, and such a thing should never happen. During the negotiations, in verse 13, the sons of Yaakov respond in a deceptive manner, the whole time having in mind their sister has been defiled, she has been violated. They agree to enter into a pact with the people of Shechem to coexist on the condition that they perform circumcision. But it seems that the circumcision is a ploy. And we're told in chapter 34, verse 25, on the third day when the men were in pain, the two sons of Yaakov, Shimon and Levi, the brothers of Dinah, each took their sword, and they come upon the city and kill all the males, and in particular kill Shechem and Hamor. And they take their sister and they leave. And in verse 30, Yaakov responds and says to Shimon and Levi, "You have made me ugly. You have made me putrid among the people of the land. And I am few in number, and they will gather upon me and slay me. And I and my family, my household, will be destroyed." And the response of Shimon and Levi is, "Shall they make us our sister into a prostitute?" There is a very interesting discussion among the commentaries as to whether Shimon and Levi were justified in what they do. Maimonides tries to present a justification by saying that rape is something which is a violation of the Noahide laws, punishable by death. One could add, stealing is also a violation, stealing of a person, punishable by death. And Maimonides adds that all those who are aware of what happened should have brought them to trial. And by not doing so, they too become accomplices to the crime and liable to the death penalty. Nachmanides disagrees and feels that what Shimon and Levi did was excessive. Yaakov condemns them, condemns their act, but does it from a geopolitical perspective. Their act potentially has endangered his family. In our section, he doesn't deal with the morality of what they did. What I'm interested in is their motivation and their response to Yaakov. Our sister has been defiled. She has been made into a prostitute. Can we just sit back and allow such a thing to happen and not respond? Shimon and Levi commit an act of zealotry. They are defending a principle, the honor of Dinah, the honor of their family. Certainly, among a number of commentaries, if not most commentaries, their act is seen as being problematic. Although their motivation is pure, their response is excessive, brutal. Let us now go to our parsha. The focus of our parsha is the story of Joseph and his brothers. And it is clear from the outset that there is a lot of tension. And one might even say that Joseph invites that tension, exacerbates it. Joseph comes to the point where his brothers hate him. And then in chapter 37, verse 13, 14, Jacob tries to diffuse the situation by sending Joseph to seek the peace of his brothers. I'm interested in now looking at verse 18. When Joseph comes to Dothan, seeking his brothers, and one can say, honestly, looking for a reconciliation, it says the brothers see him from a distance. And before he can come near to them, they plot to kill him. And then in verse 19, we're told, a man says to his brother, behold, the master of dreams, that one, is coming. And now let us kill him and throw him in one of the pits. And we will say a wild beast has devoured him. And then let us see what will be of his dreams. Who are the brothers that are plotting to kill Joseph? It is unclear from the text. In verse 21, it says, Reuven heard, and he tried to save him. So clearly, Reuven is not among the plotters. Subsequently, we're told that Judah, in verse 26, says to the brothers, what profit is there if we kill him and cover up his blood? Let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. Which means that evidently Yehudah was also not interested in killing him. By the process of elimination, it seems to be that the brothers who wanted to kill Joseph are Shimon and Levi. If Reuven and Yehudah, who are the leaders, the eldest, are not in on the plot, Shimon and Levi are the most likely candidates and would also fit in with their personalities. They already have a track record of wiping out a whole city. In the story of Shechem, Nachmanides raises the question, how is it possible that these righteous men would do such an act? And I would take his lead and say, in our story, how could they imagine killing their brother? It sounds absolutely horrific. I would like to suggest, and I want to make it clear, not justify, but understand, that in a very convoluted way, they may see that eliminating Yosef ultimately is what can preserve their family. It seems to be, from the story of Dinah, that they are very, very proud of their family, of the honor of their family, and will not tolerate that honor being tarnished, being destroyed. And by the same token, they see Yosef as a threat, someone who ultimately has delusions of grandeur, who might enslave his brothers. And hence, they plot a preemptive strike. In the same way that they speak deceptively, cunningly, to the people of Shechem, they plot to kill Yosef. They devise a whole scheme to cover their tracks. What I'm trying to get at is that Shimon and Levi are not killers. They are not evil people. Otherwise, they would have not remained within the Jewish people, within the family of Yaakov. Shimon and Levi have principles, very lofty principles, but they also think that the means can justify the end, that somehow taking extraordinary action, killing, can be justified for the sake of this higher goal, even where there may be alternative ways of dealing with the situation. Let us fast forward to next week's parsha. In next week's parsha, when the brothers come down to Egypt during a time of famine, seeking food, coming before the man that they see as the viceroy of Egypt, not knowing it is their brother, they're accused of being spies. And not only that, but they are told, one of the brothers will have to remain here when you bring back the food. In order to corroborate your story, you will have to bring back your youngest brother. This is chapter 42, verse 21. When the brothers hear what has been decreed upon them, it says, Vayomru ish el achiv, and a man says to his brother, Aval ashemim anachnu, we are guilty for our brother. We saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us and we didn't hear him. And therefore there has come upon us this calamity. It doesn't say which brothers are talking. It could be all the brothers, although it's clear from the next verse that it's not Reuven who's saying this. I would like to posit that the same Ish el Achiv who wanted to kill Joseph, those two brothers are now saying we were guilty. And very interestingly, the guilt which they have, and by the way, the word ashemim means guilt, not a mistake. It's acknowledging the full weight of the evil act which they perpetrated. And what was it that they were guilty of? Cruelty, insensitivity. They saw their brother pleading, and they refused to listen. This is a problem of zealotry. To what degree is it that even if somebody is motivated by lofty ideals, that they take measures which are excessive, that they then become brutal, cruel, and the brothers here are acknowledging it, Shimon and Levi, and they say, therefore this calamity has come upon us. Not only do they recognize they did something wrong and the full magnitude of what they did, but they are also seeing a measure for measure. They are now experiencing what it means to be victimized by someone who has the power, to be treated cruelly, to have someone who doesn't hear you, and in a certain way they accept their fate. If we look at the end of last week's parasha, interestingly, when Joseph sends his brothers back to bring food to the family, it says in chapter 42, verse 24, he takes from them Shimon, and he binds them before their eyes. And Rashi quotes two explanations. One, Shimon was the one who threw him into the pit. He was the one who said to Levi, the dreamer is coming, let us kill him. Is Joseph taking revenge? Is this maybe also an educational measure to humble Shimon, to make him appreciate what Joseph has gone through? But Rashi quotes another explanation, which says, Joseph wanted to separate Shimon from Levi, divide and conquer, because he was afraid that together they might plot to kill him. Not as Joseph, but as the second in command to Pharaoh, as the one who is a threat to them. And so the strategy is divide them. I'll come back to this a little bit later. If we go to the end of the parsha, of next week's parsha, after Joseph has planted his cup in the sacks of the brothers, and he accuses them of having stolen his cup, the response of the brothers, with Judah taking the lead, and if we look at this, this is in chapter 44, chapter 44, verse 16. Judah says, "What shall we say to our master? How can we justify ourselves? God has found the sin of your servants. We will now be slaves to you, both us and the one in whose sack you found the cup." Earlier, we're told that when the cup is discovered in the sack of Binyamin, in verse 13, the brothers tear their garments as an expression of mourning. I would like to posit that Shimon and Levi have learned something from their experiences. We no longer find them plotting to eliminate Benjamin, to somehow save the group by making one of them a scapegoat. They go through a very traumatic period, but they become strengthened by acknowledging the wrong that they did, by learning that there are different ways of responding to a situation, and that perhaps they should not be the one to play God. As much as they have a sense, a profound sense, of justice, of honor, it does not give them a license to take the law into their own hands, and they become profoundly aware of how they may very well have to pay the price for their actions. At the end of the book of Bereishit, the last thing which Jacob does before he dies is to bless his sons, to transfer his legacy to them. It is very interesting what he says to Shimon and Levi. In chapter 49, verse 5, "Shimon and Levi are brothers. The instruments of violence are their wares. Let my soul not come into their secret. In their gathering, let my honor not be united. In their anger, they killed a man, and it was their desire to uproot an ox. May their anger be cursed because it is ferocious, and their wrath because it is harsh. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." It is very interesting that Jacob waits till the day of his death to say this. Perhaps Jacob is intimidated by his sons. It would not be out of character, since we know how much Jacob is afraid of people who exercise power, and how much he seeks to avoid a confrontation with them. But these are his sons. And I would like to point out two things in this blessing. On the surface, the blessing which he gives them sounds like a curse. But there are two things in the blessing that could actually be seen as positive. First of all, Jacob never curses them. He curses their wrath. Arur apam. According to one Midrashic interpretation, which Rashi brings, when he says to them, "Your wares are utensils of violence," the explanation which is given is that what you did, you stole from my brother Esav. Esav is a man of violence, but you inherently are not. Throw away those utensils which don't really belong to you, which is a way of saying, inherently, you are not brutal, vicious people. You somehow adopted that. Get rid of it. To their credit, Jacob speaks of them as being brothers. And I might add, when they do what they do, in their own, sometimes perhaps distorted way, they are expressing their sense of brotherhood. But the last thing which I'd like to note is Jacob says, I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch sees this as a blessing. And he notes the following. This refers to the fact that both Shimon and Levi did not actually receive a portion of the land of Israel. The tribe of Levi received 48 cities that were scattered among the 12 tribes, never having their own separate portion of land. The tribe of Shimon did not receive a separate inheritance of land, but was subsumed under the portion within the framework of the tribe of Yehudah. And Rabbi Hirsch says, by not giving them land, by scattering them, Jacob is now taking a certain power which they have and channeling it in its proper context. Zealotry can be something very, very positive if done in the proper format. When Jews are oppressed, when Jews are persecuted, during the many periods of Jewish history, the Crusades, the Holocaust, it was important to have Jews who were zealots, who would stand up proud, who would not allow themselves to be dehumanized, who would rally their comrades to heroic action, who would maintain the spirit of the Jewish people, no matter what misfortune befell them. In times of persecution, zealotry is absolutely essential to keep the spirit of the Jewish people alive. But in times of affluence, when the Jewish people are flourishing, it is important to divide the zealots, to not give them a power base. Just as Joseph separated Shimon from Levi in order to thwart any combined effort to kill him, so too Shimon and Levi have to learn to not become zealots in an offensive, excessive way, but to learn to channel it for the good of the Jewish people and ultimately in the defense of principles that are very, very precious. Next week, we will be celebrating the festival of Hanukkah and commemorate the victory of the Maccabees, the dedication, rededication of the temple. The Maccabees were zealots, zealots who kept the Jewish spirit alive. But even in the story of Hanukkah, that zealotry, years later, became very problematic when it led to corrupt political institutions. Shimon and Levi can be a model of people who have a passion, who have ideals, who are prepared to stand up for what they believe in, but who also need to learn how to channel that in the proper direction, who make mistakes, but in the end are able to acknowledge that and even pay the penalty for it. May we learn from their example. May we learn what it is to stand up for what we believe in, to be passionate, to fight for those things that we need to fight for, but to also temper that, to not be excessive, to be willing to recognize when we make mistakes and to grow from that. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.